I'd like to use as a text this morning two quotations from the lips of Jacob. One quotation is, "The Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." And the other quotation is, "That I have seen God face to face, and I'm still alive." Jacob was an extraordinary man in many ways, very puzzling, and it is not my purpose to deal with Jacob this morning, but simply to establish the setting of what I have to say. Jacob was fleeing from the relentless logic of his past behavior, and he stopped to catch his breath and to sleep. And as he slept, he dreamed, and as he dreamed, there was a ladder extended from earth to heaven, and these angelic bodies were going up and down. And then when he woke up, suddenly dawned upon him that even in his diseased conscience, even in his disordered life, God was present. And he said, "The Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it even. I didn't expect to find God here. I thought God was only where there was goodness. But he's here. So I'll mark this place." He took a stone and put it down, and he marked the place. And all the people who journeyed through that part of the country, when they saw the stone, as was the custom, the stone out of character, out of context, they knew that the stone marked a place where a man had had an encounter with Yahweh. So as a tribute to his religious experience, the traveler picked up a stone and threw it there. And one of the ways by which altars emerged was that simple way. One man standing in the presence of the symbol that marked the spot where another man had encountered God, saluted that experience by adding his stone. The other, Jacob is running again. And this time he's frightened because he's sure that Esau is going to catch him and kill him. And he wondered, what could he do to placate Esau? And in his clever fashion, he worked out some plans. And after working them out in detail, he sent his family on across the river. Then he stayed on this side. And he was alone, as Moffat puts it, and struggling in his sleep, of course. And an angel this time, or some heavenly body, not a part of a company now, no ups and downs of a ladder, no host, but just a solitary figure wrestling with a solitary man. And he wrestled with him. Until the break of day. And then as day began emerging, this man said, "I'll have to go now. You'd better turn me loose. And Jacob said, I won't do it unless you bless me. And he blessed him. He mocked him. He touched him at a certain spot. So the story goes. And after that, he limped for the rest of his days, wrestling with an angel. Interesting. But as Jacob reflected upon the meaning of this experience, he said, In that experience, I met God face to face. And I am still alive. Well, that's the setting. Now let's work at it a little. I'm suggesting the fundamental proposition this morning that every life is involved eventually in some form of crisis. Now, the crisis may be very noticeable, may be very dramatic, or the crisis may be so subtle, so pervasive, so much a part of the landscape that one does not realize that it was crisis until afterwards one looks back upon it and says, ah, that was it. Wherever the human spirit encounters experience that strips it to whatever literal substance there is in the human spirit, there, in that kind of experience, man has encountered God. And it's crisis. For what is crisis? Crisis is the thing that happens when forces that seem to push one out of the familiar pattern of security or living, out of the familiar context of behavior, something happens that pushes you out of that. And even as that happens, there's something in you that pulls you back. Pushes, pulls. And the tug that goes on, the tension between these two things, is the thing that makes for the crisis. It's what we mean when we say that a person has a crisis and a disease, isn't it? That the disease, whatever the disease germs may be, or whatever the disease is, it keeps building and building and building until it seems as if the forces that are making for the destruction of the cells and all the rest of it are going to get the upper hand. If they get the upper hand, then it means that the creative resourcefulness of life, the vitality in the organism, will be permanently blocked. And for hours, the doctor says, well, I don't know. And what does he mean? He means that I don't know whether these forces that are negative, that are working for the disintegration of the cells, will win over this creative churning of vitality that keeps pushing in terms of newness, in terms of health, in terms of strength. Now, the crisis is past when one or the other wins. And we say that we only say the crisis is past if the person lives. We don't say the crisis is past if the person dies, but it really, the crisis has passed. Now, Now that's on the physiological level. Now, the same thing happens in your personal, in terms of personal experiences and personal tragedies. And the solution of a crisis can take place on two levels. One level is the level of ordinary skill and competency. You may have, if you are having some sort of tremendous emotional crisis, it is quite possible that at the level of the moment, at the level of the facts that are present in that little time's interval, you may seek skill and help and of a doctor, of a psychiatrist, of an analyst, and that solution, that help that comes will reach back into a whole series of more or less quantitative factors that have entered into the making of this crisis, and that is very tremendous. And for many, many, many human beings, the solution to the crisis at that level is all that they can manage. That's a great deal. Because often it makes a difference between life and death, between sustained and indefinite torture and some peace of mind and tranquility of spirit. But religion thinks in terms of crisis at an even deeper level. Let me illustrate it in two or three ways and then pull it together and I'll be through. I don't know whether you've seen, and this is not by way of a plug, I don't know whether you've seen the movie about Beethoven yet. It's over at some theater in town. And I won't say which theater. Little by little, Beethoven realizes that he is losing his hearing. And there is a scene which may be apocryphal, but there is a scene in which he is conducting some symphony, and because he can't hear, the singers are going one way and the orchestra is doing something else, and then people begin to shake their heads, and finally he just looks around in his dazed confusion, realizing that now everybody knows that he is deaf, and he's tried to keep it as a secret for so long. And then he stumbles out and goes home, and he walks in broken. And he throws all the music that he's written, scatters it on the floor, then he bangs on the piano with his fist, and then he gets up and walks around and he begins to talk to God, and he says, "What's the matter? Are you afraid that I might compete with your power? Why did you give me this gift if the only thing that you wanted to do was to mock me? What good is the gift if I can hear no more?" And he remembers what the priest had told him in a previous conversation. The priest had said that God was in this. Even though you cannot resolve it at the level of the doctor, the physical thing, But God is in it. And perhaps, said this priest to Beethoven, perhaps God wants you to hear melodies that you can't hear if your hearing is confused with external noises. And perhaps the hearing with which you hear now will bring the kind of lift and joy and hope and wonder to human beings that they have not known before. And all of this goes through Beethoven's mind. And then, after he has exhausted himself with all of his bitterness and his tirade and his polemics, a lady comes in and talks to him a little, and she reminds him of another dimension of his life. And then she breaks down and begins crying. And as she cries, and he tries to comfort her. And he says, isn't it strange? You came here to comfort me. Now it ends up that I'm comforting you. I understand now. Go out to the outside world and tell them that I have conquered the silence of my ears. Tell them that Beethoven hears. Crisis? Confrontation? Divine encounter? I wonder. When I was in away 3 weeks ago, I lived in a home for 4.5 days. A home in which there was a little child, a spastic child, been that way from birth. Unable to speak, fastened by a harness to his little wheelchair. And I watched the mother and the father and the 18-year-old daughter. They had learned how to communicate with Dickie at a level that was active in the history of the race before man learned how to speak. For language is late in the development of man on the planet. Together they drop themselves back into a vast feeling continuum from which he had never quite emerged. And moving with him at that level, all sorts of miraculous things became possible. I wanted to see if I could communicate with him. And it was very wonderful. I had 2 hours rest between 8 and 10 every night before my 10 o'clock session. And I noticed that this boy always enjoyed the television. And so I sat, this is really not on the point, but I'll have to tell you anyway. I sat watching him watch the television. Of course, his mother was always there because no time during the 24 hours could he be alone, because if his neck were twisted in a certain angle, certain
things would happen in the muscles, and he'd choke to death, so that someone had to be with him always, 24 hours. I watched his reaction to various pictures on the television. But I was out of his line of vision, watching these reactions. I watched them for 2 nights. Then the third night, I moved up so that he could see me, if he wanted to. And then I reacted as he reacted. And then I noticed that he was looking that way at me every now and then. Then I'd look at him, then he'd look off and look back at the television. So I knew that the eyes of Texas were upon me. So after 4 nights, then it was a kind of communication between us. This reacting to the same thing in the television. So Friday night when I was leaving at about 11 o'clock, I went by his room to tell him goodbye. And then I stood under the light so he could see my face. And then I reacted to 2 or 3 things. And then immediately he reacted. And I knew that we were talking to each other. Now, what has happened to make that mother and that father and that 18-year-old daughter deal creatively with that kind of experience? What does it? As long as the individual says, back to my thesis, you see, as long as the individual says, no, I will pull back, I will rebel, I will spend my energy in resentment, I will strike out against, I will change, until I spill all my vitriolic feelings over life, over God, over everything. As long as there is this shrinking back, one lives in a state of extended crisis. But when one is able, amazing thing happens. You know what it is? It is this. One discovers that the most fundamental belief of the mind and the spirit of man with reference to all of life and all the levels of experience is that there is an order, there is a rationality, there is a logic that structures every dimension of man's awareness. And when I pull back from my encounter, it says that the encounter, the thing from which I shrink, is chaotic. There's chaos there. There's no order there. There's no logic there. There's no rationality there. That it is, therefore, out of the reach of the power of the Spirit to unlock. But when I go forward to it, it says that there is an order, that there is a fundamental principle of orderliness, of rationality, of God.
in everything.
And I shall not let it go until the divine in it reveals itself to me. Now, when you are caught in that pocket, you are stripped to whatever there is in you that's literal, whatever there is in you that's irreducible, whatever there is in you that is ultimate in its character. You are cut down to that, beyond which there is no retreat. And there you must stand. And when you get there and stand, and you look into the eyes of whatever it is, you see that the thing on which you're standing is the thing at which you're looking. And then you know what peace means. You have that which the world cannot touch and cannot take away from you, because you have looked into the face of God and you're still alive. Hallelujah.